Welcome to the EMS Educator Podcast, powered by Prodigy EMS.
Join us for relevant, high-quality discussions around the best practices in EMS education. You'll find interviews with experts in EMS, education, simulation, medical direction, leadership, and more.
Hello, and welcome to this month's edition of the EMS Educator Podcast. I'm one of your many hosts, Rob Lawrence. So we've got an exciting chat for you today. But first of all, last time, of course, our amazing co-host Hilary Gates was on, quote, other duties as assigned. I'm delighted to say that she's back again. Hilary, welcome back.
The delight is all mine, sir. Thank you, Rob. And super excited today because we're going to talk about the little ones, our pediatric patients. And we're going to talk to Stephanie Ashford from Missouri about this because she has a lot of good advice and history and has done a ton of work in the field. And I'm just super excited to have her on board. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you guys today.
And of course, Maya's here with us, being the guest host, the ghost, and Maya will insert her medical director comments and advice and wisdom as well. Hi, Maya.
Hi.
Stephanie, go ahead and introduce yourself for us.
It's great to be with you guys today. My name's Stephanie Ashford. I'm the Division Chief of Clinical Practice at St. Charles County Ambulance District. I've been in EMS for about 27 years. I've been with the district for about 19. I've been in almost every role you can be in pre-hospital, and my favorite patients are the tiny ones. I was born to be a mom, and that's my favorite role, and I kind of transitioned that into being provider mom.
Great. Sounds good. Maya, tell us about this project that we're going to discuss today.
There's lots of reasons that I'm very excited to have Stephanie on our podcast. The first is that she's somebody that I truly admire as an educator, and I've gotten to work with her in so many different contexts, learning from her in education and quality. And I think she epitomizes somebody who actually blends those two things extraordinarily well because she understands them both. In the bigger context, nationally, EMS for children has been promoting the pre-hospital pediatric readiness project. And coming up in May, there is going to be a national assessment that EMS agencies can voluntarily participate in to examine their own practices and say, how do we make it so that we're ready to take care of, as Stephanie calls them, the tiny humans? And one of the ways to prepare for that is that there's a checklist that lets you look through all the different elements of what are we already doing. And the first element of that checklist has to do with education and competency of EMS clinicians. And when I thought about how can we bring on somebody who has a wealth of experience in really doing this and taking an agency and saying, I'm going to implement meaningful education that empowers EMS clinicians to take care of sick children, the first person I thought about was Stephanie. And so I saw her give a presentation at NEMSI last summer about how she used rapid cycle deliberate practice to do this within her agency. And she's done lots of other things as well. And so that's why that's who I wanted to share her knowledge with the world about how to do this.
That's amazing. Thank you, Maya, for the very big mouthful of the PPRP and really setting the tone for us here. And Stephanie, when we start thinking about whether or not our EMS agencies and our systems are ready and prepared, as stated in the title here, we want to rely on you for giving us kind of some guidance on how to do that. And so let's start with kind of what has led you to focus on pediatric education as a training and education officer?
I mean, beyond the obvious, which Maya stated for me, I love the tiny humans. And also they're terrifying because all their parts are smaller, right? Their bodies are smaller, their drug dosages are smaller, and they require math, which we don't have to do all the time. Those are the obvious reasons. But, you know, the less obvious reasons are our agency, much like many agencies, have zero tertiary pediatric services available to us. We have to travel outside of our service area to get patients to definitive care, which turns into longer transport times, longer time with the
the tiny humans, that we have to care for them, which means we have to be better at our jobs to do this. At our agency, we have participated in a state level ambulance readiness program for almost 10 years. And it's a little more rudimentary than the national project, but it really set us up nicely to participate in the national project. And the base level is just to make sure you had equipment, right? Can you take care of tiny humans? Do you have the right sized stuff? And then it was, do you have an expert who's willing to champion this? And this very basic level. And it moved from there to things like education programs, and public safety piece was very key to that. And so when you look at those pieces of the state project, they translated into this national project that we're embarking on, and they expanded it in a very creative and meaningful way that even we have work to do to meet those needs.
And tell us about, because it's worth mentioning here, tell us about the STARS program in your system. When I was at EMS World, we profiled the STARS program and really highlighted it because it was so unique. And it has to do with medically fragile patients and kind of what people call high-tech kids. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, for sure. Now, it's not my program. I want to state that. It is housed at Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital in St. Louis. It started off at a small agency in Southern County around St. Louis, but it was quickly identified as really valuable and really translatable to another, a larger area. And Cardinal Glennon has championed that. It is a program for high-tech kids, meaning medically fragile. And for the longest time, our agency had the largest group until they spread to Florida. And now Florida's overtaken our title. But we have, right now, we have about 125 children enrolled in it. And what they do is they have pre-plans for EMS, because a lot of these things are terrifying and they're novel. So we may never have seen the type of tracheostomy they have or the type of vagal nerve stimulator. We just came across a new one the other day that is, it's not triggered by a magnet, it's triggered by pressure. So they have wires going under their skin to both sides of it. We have benzo-refractory status epilepticus children, so we need special medical plans for those things that we don't learn in our basic training. We have medical pre-plans for it. And so there's a lot of programs around the country that are interested in this type of model. And through the last, not quite 10 years, but close, we've been able to really hone in inclusion and exclusion criteria. And it is that. It is if they have some kind of medical technology or pathology that we didn't train for, or that the whole group of our providers couldn't take care of, they get a pre-plan. And they graduate, right? Sometimes they graduate because they get better. And sometimes they graduate, unfortunately, because they pass away. Sometimes they graduate because they move to an area that doesn't have this program. But so we have a constant influx, and unfortunately, we have a bit of a constant outflow as well.
I was just going to jump in here. You really triggered something, and I just went back into our own back catalog of the EMS Educator podcast. And according to Amazon, it's season 2, episode 16. Did you realize we're in the second season? Season 2, episode 16, where we had Tracy Coffey and Ashley Huff on talking about OB care deserts and issues there. And it's a very similar thing about getting the patient to the right place in the right time. And we're now faced with challenges with EMS systems closing, hospitals closing, as you say, transport distances increasing beyond that which we can, you know, manage A, the service, and B, the patient. And so, you know, there's a theme emerging here, and I just wanted to sort of make that point. So go back and listen to episode 16 with Drs. Coffey and Huff, make similar points.
So now that we know why and sort of the breadth of different types of programs that you have, can you give a bit of an overview for others about how are education and quality improvement linked at your agency?
Sure. First of all, quality improvement is like a journey, right? You're never going to reach perfection, because as soon as you get there, you want to do better even still. So it's a constant reach, this mastery idea. And at our agency, And as most agencies, quality improvement lived in the training division, whether you believe that's how it should be or not, that's logistically how it ends up. And so a lot of things we try to deal with foundationally with education and then structurally through quality improvement. We've always done a bit of pediatric training, but in 2016, we started doing annual refresher training, and we always had pediatrics was a piece because it's required to get your license back. And so your annual refresher had to require ped. Then around 2015, we rolled out an adult CCR pit crew style resuscitation, and our pediatric doctors on our physician advisory board said, no, thank you. Please keep that passive oxygenation craziness away from our tiny humans. And we were like, okay. But when we came back to the meetings with, you know, triple survival of neuro intact at a hospital survival, the ped doctors were like, well, maybe use that on our bigger kids, or, you know, we'll come back to the table and talk about this. And we did. We started doing it on the adolescents first. And then we got really granular and worked with them to build a ped-specific pit crew model that included using, you know, at the time, novel technologies like the eye gel. Now it's pretty ubiquitous through our field. And immediately we had some amazing results. That's always great for any new projects to have an early win. And we had 4 within the first 6 months that survived discharge, you know, and that immediately gets buy-in from the crews, most importantly, but also from the hospitals and the, you know, participating agencies, fire crews as well. Education-wise, shortly after that, we started including neonatal resuscitation for the pre-hospital provider. The national course is great, but it is primarily targeted for hospital neonatal resuscitations. And unfortunately, because of our geography, we've been having a lot of out-of-hospital deliveries for crazy things, right? We don't live in a healthcare desert in our county, but we do sort of have an OB desert. And just like you mentioned earlier, and so the neonatal resuscitations we were having were for these really out of the world type of deliveries. We had a pretty spectacular one last summer. We had a 23-weeker born in call that was 450 grams, and they were able to use our neonatal program we do every year now. And we had a clinical save. She was in the hospital for almost 5 months, but she was discharged home. What we think is neuro intact. Now we won't know for several years if there's any deficit, but neuro intact as much as any other NICU baby. And so we really do prize that now. And we got a lot of buy-in due to that one particular call.
Congratulations on those accomplishments, by the way. You just listed them as if it was, you know, just, oh, that was just Wednesday. To say those things and really show that there is a link between the training and the preparedness and then the success and the outcomes is huge. I like that you highlighted the on-call birth, which is extraordinarily rare, but is so, shall I say, dramatic and rare for paramedics and EMTs to see that they're going to cling to that the same way they would cling to, you know, I did a trach, or, you know, or something like that. So that's worthwhile, even though it's an N of one, it's worth motivating them for sure.
Yeah, we did lots of clinical commendations for the whole team, as well as, you know, making sure they recognize this is a once in a career save that you had here. You know, it's magical. It's magical for that to happen in the hospital and survive. It's unheard of, you know, nationally. We maybe have it a couple times a year in the country to have something like that. And it's just amazing. The quality improvement side of the house, we started with our quality improvement project doing like TCD measures, which most people are interested in. And as a country, we're getting better at measuring stuff. We have organizations like the National EMS Quality Alliance, and the EMSP has put a ton of time and energy into improving the community of practice around community, around quality and safety. And in our house, that started with time critical diagnosis, which is the stroke, STEMI, trauma, those are the things that like JCO at the hospital measures for their accreditation. And so, of course, they want us to do really good on those because it makes them look really good if we do really good on those. So we started our quality improvement journey with those types of things and cardiac arrest. But quickly, I was like, hey, we have all these tiny humans and they are very critical as well. We tried to figure out how do we measure what is critical and what's not critical. And along that journey, I happened to sit through Dr. John Hoyle's presentation at NAMSP in 2020. It was amazing. I'm sure it's recorded somewhere in Prodigy. But he presented work he did on simulation with paramedics on pediatric medication delivery. And he had several common errors. And I was like, we treat those same patients. We need to work on this. And so we built some very specific training around this. And I think we'll talk about it in a minute, but that was one of the things that the project he published this summer before the presentation was, it was based in Michigan. I believe it's called MI Peers or an MI Medic. There was two different arms of the publication. And they talk about, you know, strategies for improving these very common cognitive errors that we're making in the field. And so we took the lessons he learned from this project and we implemented them at our agency, both in training and in quality.
Amazing discussion so far, but let's just take a second to have a message from our sponsor, EMS Gives Life.
Hello, I'm Christine Fichter, the Executive Director of EMS Gives Life. At EMS Gives Life, our mission is simple. We educate the EMS first responder community on how to become a living organ or bone marrow donor, and then provide support if you choose to give this gift of life. Our organization was inspired by Pro-EMS paramedic Will Lindbergh's selfless decision to anonymously donate a portion of his liver, saving the life of a 3-year-old boy. We know our community is full of heroes who perform life-saving acts every day. It is this heroism and selflessness that we're counting on. More than 6,000 people die each year on the transplant waiting list. Deceased donors are simply not enough. Living organ donors are desperately needed, and our community is up for the challenge. Would you consider being a living donor if you had the support you needed and the assurance that you will go to the top of the list if you ever needed a transplant in the future? Through our partnerships, we can make those promises. If you're curious about living organ or bone marrow donation, let's talk. And if you're already a living donor, we'd love to hear your story. You can find us at emsgiveslife.org. Thank you.
As always, thank you, Christine, from EMS Gives Life. Don't forget, please like and subscribe if you're a first-time listener. And as Hillary is the keeper of our podcast stats, she tells us that more and more of you are liking and subscribing and downloading the EMS Educator podcast every time. So please keep that up. So today we're talking, and here comes the tongue twister, pre-hospital pediatric readiness projects with the amazing Stephanie Ashford. And many of our mentors out there are going to be yelping now is, of course, one of the things you said and I wrote down straight away is quality improvement is a journey. And we agree wholeheartedly on the EMS Educator podcast. So to carry on that journey, over to you, H.
Maybe we should make t-shirts. Quality improvement is a journey.
Bumper stickers, definitely.
Okay. Socks. Okay. Stephanie, one of the things that we love to do on this podcast is make sure that people can take away actual ways to implement this great advice and also understand that there are hurdles to operationalizing these types of things. And so that's where we want to go next. And since you've been doing it for so long and you've been doing it so well, that's the kind of advice and help that you can provide to our listeners. So, you know, it's one thing to send somebody to a conference, listen to a talk, get excited about research. It's another thing to come back and actually implement it. Talk a little bit about that for us.
Yeah, sure. In addition to Dr. Hoyle's work that he submitted through NAMSP and pre-hospital emergency care, we had recently been looking into a program called Rapid Cycle Deliberate Practice, and it was specifically published by Dr. Elizabeth Hunt at Johns Hopkins, who was working on a way to get her residents to be able to treat these tiny humans in the ICU when they were terrified, they didn't have enough time to practice. And she's like, time is our most valuable resource. How do we make the most of it? Because traditional SIM takes a long time. It's really valuable in the foundational learning stage, but how do we take somebody who's pretty good at their job and make them an expert? And this model seemed to be very successful in the work that she published. So we took that and we got some people certified in using that model, and we went forth and did it as a project. We went to see, can we make our crews both more confident and more competent in delivering pediatric medications, and using John Hoyle's framework to say, we know people make mistakes with this stuff. Dr. Hoyle said it. How do we make it in practice? So the model itself is based on sort of three pieces of traditional educational, like, pedagogy. The first one, the oldest one, is mastery learning. And here's my next quote for you. Mastery is in the reaching, not the arriving. And it's not mine. That's not mine. It belongs to Dr. Sarah Lewis from this really great book called The Rise. And if you need to read something on the airplane next time, that's the one to read, because it's just beautiful. It's like poetry. But I really do believe that mastery is in the reaching and not the arriving. And some of the framework for this comes from Vosky's zone of proximal development, which is, you know, we don't want to teach you from the beginning. We want to teach you from where you are to reach to the next level. And so that's kind of the foundation of mastery learning. There's a ton of educational research around mastery learning. They also combine elements of deliberate practice. And again, we see the zone of proximal development in that deliberate practice model. Dr. Anders Ericsson has a book called Peak about basically how do we make experts out of people? And it's not practice makes perfect. It's perfect practice makes perfect. And so you take that expertise model and you interrupt the error as it's happening so that their brain never forms the inaccurate steps for any process you're teaching. And then the third piece is crisis resource management. We know in our field that is a huge contributor to team success, because we generally don't work by ourselves. Sometimes in the back of the ambulance we are by ourselves, but very often we are in teams. And so that soft skill, I guess I would argue that it's not a soft skill. It's non-technical skill. And that crisis resource management refers to principles with dealing with cognitive and interpersonal behaviors that contribute to improved teams' performance. And so we took those, the grander model was the rapid cycle deliberate practice. Those are the pieces that contribute to this model. And basically, you build in simulation where you interrupt the error, and the model is pause, prescribe, replay. So once they reach those errors you know they're about to make, you pause the scenario, you fix the error, and you replay that piece of it so they never build a mental model that includes errors. And it allows you to go quickly through a simulation versus the traditional sim model is like the simulation is the vehicle for the debrief. It's like my coffee is the vehicle for my creamer. The simulation is really just a tool to get us to the reflection. And while that's beautiful in foundational learning, it's very hard to get the time to do a good one in practice. And so I'm not discounting any of our sim experts that have come before me, but when we are trying to make an expert out of someone quickly, this rapid cycle deliberate model, deliberate practice model is a great one to utilize.
Yeah, I use rapid cycle deliberate practice around things like cardiac arrest and rare skills. And I think when thinking about, you know, is this the right model to use? My question is the psychomotor skill, including the way that I manage my crew, is that the essential element versus do I want to like reflect like cognitively on these complex clinical judgment questions that I'm making, whereas like a more, you know, in-depth long-acting simulation would be more appropriate. I think that the true value of rapid cycle deliberate practice is it allows people to know what right feels like. Like I can think so many times back to when I was learning how to do a procedure and just like messed up and messed up and messed up. And then everybody would tell me how I messed up, but I like never felt like what it was like to be right until I finally passed that threshold. And I was like, oh, that's what right feels like, right? Like, that's what the cords look like when I intubate somebody. That's what the pop feels like when I do. I still remember my first successful LP. Like, it allows you to pass this threshold. This is what good feels like. And once you get to what good feels like, one, you know how to get there. And it also gives you a confidence the next time you approach the procedure. And I think there's so many things that we do so rarely is like we go through it and we talk about what we did it wrong, but we don't give people the opportunity to be successful, which is so important for both of those things, especially in really scary situations. And then thinking about, you know, pediatrics, I think that's sort of the epitome, like these pediatric skills. That's sort of the epitome of something that is going to be rare, high stakes, and you want to know what good feels like, especially given like the chance that you may not have actually experienced what good feels like in real life to give you the confidence going into it.
And if I can jump on that real quick, when I was teaching high school, I learned about this idea about the zone of proximal development. And Stephanie, you said all the really awesome education words like pedagogy and stuff. Good job. And one of the things I talked a lot about when I was teaching other teachers was to really think about yourself as a coach in a lot of ways. And we can liken the performance on a call that a paramedic is held to a certain standard, the same way we liken it to a professional tennis player or basketball player or a pitcher or something like that. Never in a sport would you allow a pitcher to throw the ball the wrong way or use the wrong technique over and over again, because that muscle memory and mental memory is just going to cement itself. So we should likewise not do that in EMS either. We should make sure that, as Maya said, you feel the pop and you understand what it feels like to do it correctly. So thank you for the perfect practice makes perfect, the little addition there.
So can you describe, because when I sat through your talk at NEMSI, like I knew you as a person, educator, and somebody I admire, I literally got like verklempt when you describe, like when you describe what you did, I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then I realized that you sort of got it all done during COVID, like by yourself, like you were so motivated that you made it happen. But really, I got verklempt when you talked about the results of the program measured not by, you know, smiley face, I enjoyed this training, by the impact on patient care. Like I was like there were like tears, you know, like I was like, I felt something in there because yeah. To me, it was like, this is what doing good in the world looks like. Like right here, I'm witnessing her describing it. Can you share what you did?
Yeah. So we did this project, as Maya said, during COVID, which created another level of interesting for that. Our model at our district, based on logistics and moving vehicles, required us to do like a 3-hour block of this thing. Ideally, you would do it in smaller blocks, but we had scheduled 3-hour blocks, so we did 3-hour blocks. And because it was during COVID, it was the very first time we'd all come together and had to wear masks for 3 hours in a row in training. So there was a lot of grumbling about that during the thing. However, when we measured afterwards, and we do this with our education programs every single time, because we want to get better every single time. Quality improvement is not just for clinical practice. It is for education as well, for education, not just from education. So we measure things, and the method I'm most familiar with is Kirkpatrick's model for training evaluation, but there are many ways to measure your educational success. So we do measure the smile sheets. Did they like it? Did their confidence improve? Were those come from the reaction level, the foundation level? But when we started looking at things like knowledge acquisition and behavior change, we have to look. The knowledge acquisition came from, you know, assessments afterwards. The behavior change, we look to our documentation and performance. And then did it reach the patients? That's always the hardest one to get. And we can't get it on all of our trainings, but we could on this one because we were already set up to capture pediatric medication delivery. And we found in the 18 months following, we had zero mathematical errors and we had zero iatrogenic injury to the patient, meaning that the providers didn't cause any injury to the patient from the medication delivery. And that's sort of the gold, like that's the thing that makes you feel clumped afterwards, because that's the worry, right? That's the terrifying part. We were able to put all those numbers together. I have them on a poster somewhere around here, but the one that makes me as an educator is the sort of the not captured in math kind of things. It's the text messages I would get after the calls. We had a pediatric resuscitation shortly after, and the crew texted me and said, look, I don't think this patient's going to survive, but I felt like that was the best code I've ever run. I could hear your voice in my head telling me to slow down, get the airway, give the drugs. He's like, I know I gave this kid the best chance that they could have at survival. Same with one of the trach changes. We had another educator with us who told a very powerful story about a kid who was actively dying in front of him. And the respite staff at this care home we used to go to a lot told them they can't take the trach out because they didn't have a spare. And we're like, we can't use the trach because it's occluded. Like, you can't take it out. They're like, watch me. And they pull it out. And, you know, of course, it's all crusted over and stuff. And it's like, what do you do now? Like, hold the opening. They bagged through it and washed it out with Dawn soap and stuck it back in. And, you know, the nurses at the home were very emotional about that. And he got to the hospital. The doctor's like, that was 100% the right thing to do. He's like, we can fix pneumonia. We can't fix anoxic brain injury from a clogged trach. And the text message I got after the training officer had said that story was, I remembered Mike's story about pulling the trach and I saved this kid because I remembered Mike's story. And so those are the things that I get to hold on to as a teacher that, you know, because I don't get to touch his patients very often anymore, but I get to hold those little nuggets with me for the rest of the rest of the career.
So thinking about, can you give an example? Those were like I'm sitting here, like what, like, are there somebody cutting onions, you know?
Yes, damn onion chopping ninjas. They're always to blame.
What were some of the cases that you did to, like, how did you pick the cases that you did and what were the cases? Because it was a really nice example for people to get started.
For sure. Yeah, so we literally took the framework that Dr. Hoyle did and we modified it just a little bit because we wanted it to be the patients we have. So the first one was a 5-year-old drowning. That's the one we practice all the time. And so that was the confidence builder and sort of the level setting scenario we did because we wanted to know where cognitively our crews were performing before we jump into this perfect practice. I mean, we still had them do the pause, prescribe, replay piece of that, but they were very familiar with that scenario. So 5-year-old drowning. The next case was probably the most complicated, but we run it all the time. It was a 3-year-old female STARS patient who has a trach and she has seizures all the time because she has a VP shunt that she continues to grow out of or gets infected or whatever. And so they had to work through the giving of the benzodiazepines and checking the sugar and giving sugar to tiny humans is a whole nother piece. That was a specific learning point from Dr. Hoyle's presentation was how, and this broke my brain when he said it, how hypertonic D10 is, but when you give it to the patient, when it goes in their body, it becomes hypotonic because when they're hypoglycemic, they gobble up all the dextrose and leave all the water. And if you give a tiny human a bunch of water, they're going to herniate their brain. And so never, never, never hang the bag. Always draw out the medicine. And that was a key learning point in that scenario was when you're going to give sugar to a baby or an infant, draw it out of the bag, never hang the fluid. And so that was a specific learning point from Dr. Hoyle's study that we baked into this scenario. The next one was we had a 4-year-old female, possible ingestion with multisystem anaphylaxis. So we had an anaphylactic scenario in Dr. Hoyle's study. The thing that people messed up in Dr. Hoyle's study was they missed the epi. They would just skip epi, or they would mix the dose up, and almost always it was a tenfold mix up. And so we baked that into the scenario is you have to give epi to save this kid, and you have to do it correctly. And so that was a pause prescribe replay, was the epinephrine. The next one was a 6-year-old male direct burn from a fire pit with both upper extremities. And it's a pain control for pediatric scenario. That's something we really suck at. We continue to actually suck at that. So anyway, EMS in general is not great at providing pain control for kids because pain looks different in a child than it does in an adult. And so treating the pain was an objective of that scenario, and treating it correctly with the correct dosing strategy. We have several medications we can give for pain, and so we had those pieces broken out. And then the last one was an extra, because Dr. Hoyle's study was a 4-scenario study. We added a fifth because we had done it in the past and people really struggled with it. So we added it to sort of reinforce the entire program. It was a 7-month-old male with decreased responsiveness, heart rate in the 50s, and shock. And it was essentially, it was like it could be anything, like a cardiac malformation or something, but it was a Brady infant that needed resuscitation. And the learning piece was jump to the resuscitation. Don't continue to, you know, mess around with all the random diagnostic things. If this child is in shock and not perfusing, you need to jump to resuscitation. And so those were the actual scenarios. We had like a graph when I did the presentation that broke down the type of scenario. We used a pediatric assessment triangle to determine first interventions, general impressions. And that's something we request by most of our pediatric hospitals. We've talked about other types of evaluation tools, and they all definitely prefer that pediatric assessment triangle. And so we try to incorporate that into every one of our ped trainings. We had required actions, and then we had those pause, prescribe, replay, debriefs.
Right. So what do you think, right? So people looking to implement, what do you think is the optimal training schedule? Like, I mean, I think, well, there's optimal and then there's realistic and good enough. So what do you think how often do you think we need to be doing a pediatric training like this to instill pediatric preparedness?
So I think in the framework of pediatric preparedness, it's annual in the actual documents that they have. It depends. Optimal, I think, depends on the capabilities of your system, right? In the perfect world, we could practice ped stuff every month, every couple months, but we don't live in the perfect world. Most places are resource limited and they can't just drop everything and do whatever kind of training they want all the time. They have many of these different competing, conflicting priorities. I think we should do resuscitation training every few months, just like the RQI type of model where we continually do it. But what ends up happening if you oversaturate your system with these demands, you're not getting out of it what you need to get out of it. And so it's kind of like the Goldilocks of training. You want to give it enough time that you can make meaningful educational improvement, but you want it to be frequent enough that they don't completely forget everything you taught them. So I don't know that I have a right answer for that, because it is absolutely system dependent.
And Stephanie, what lessons did you learn as an educator? We love, again, to hear about the realities of this job, and many of us in EMS education are learning as we go. So kind of a, you know, maybe two-part question. What lessons did you learn as an educator? And then what would you say to those who are listening? What advice would you give, or final thoughts on how to do this well and not make the same mistakes you did?
I think you need to grow your team early. It's a lot for one person to try to manage all of it. So grow your team early. I have a really active STARS team, and I have a growing list of pediatric experts at our place that help me bring some of these things to life. So grow your team early, because you need it. Number one, you need a backup in case you get hit by a car. But number two, many hands make light work. And that's one piece of it. The other piece is that, again, mastery is in the reaching and not the arriving. The pediatric readiness project, the pre-hospital pediatric readiness project, as it is now, has some new language in it that we are working on, which is adding disaster preparedness pieces that we haven't always housed. Like emergency management houses them, the school districts house them. But as we continue on with our adult projects, we also add pediatric elements to it. So for instance, active shooter training, a piece of this is about reunification. And there's specific language in the pediatric readiness project around disaster reunification. And so it's in the reaching, not the arriving. We're always going to be working to make our pediatric care better. So make sure your team is passionate and active and ready to continue to get better over time.
Wow. Well, I have to say, Stephanie, that, you know, if I'm quoting you, which I will do a lot now, that means I'm listening, I'm paying attention. What you've said has been absolutely memorable. And I think we're all on the screen nodding with agreement. You know, you had me at QI as a journey, and then you went through to reaching, not arriving. Perfect practice makes perfect. I couldn't agree with that more. You talked about crisis resource management. Now, I'm the operator in this podcast, and I'm thinking of CRM, the other CRM, right? Crew resource management for the front of the truck, but you've actually nailed it for the back of the truck. So you've got a CRM in each end of the vehicle. Perfect. Thank you for saying that. Pause, prescribe, replay. And my personal favorite, of course, is my coffee is a vehicle for my creamer. And cheers to you, because it's been an amazing podcast. So thank you for doing that. And really, the clinical takeaway, we can fix pneumonia. We can't fix anoxic brain injury. Brilliant. Thank you. And grow your team early. Well, if I have a chance to be on your team, I'd love to be on it, because you've been amazing. And I have to say, the next time I see you at a conference and I've got my Mark, our ever-present camera guy, we're filming a whole season of Escalator with you, because you've got so much to teach us and to pass on. So, Stephanie, thank you so much for that. So who's going to bring us home today?
I'll just quickly say similar things that Rob said, but what I love here as an educator is knowing that when you rely on the work that others have done before you, and you don't reinvent the wheel, and you absolutely look at the research and the data and the science from experts, you can really craft purposeful training that focuses on what matters. And part of what we do in EMS is sometimes, unfortunately, waste time crafting training that may or may not actually improve anything. And Stephanie has shown us that with a lot of purpose and thought and a nice team surrounding us, that we can do that. So that is something I really appreciate.
My final thought is, Stephanie, you're amazing. I love you.
I love you too.
Oh, and that's really what the EMS Educator podcast is all about, having amazing people who are also amazing friends of ours, and we love you all, and thank you for joining us. So that was this month's EMS Educator podcast. Don't forget, now we're putting out an edition of this show on the first Friday of every month, so mark your calendars, tune in for that. For the moment, though, of course, thank you to Hillary and to our guest host, our ghost, and our amazing medical director, Dr. Maya Dorsett, and to our fantastic guest. Thank you very much indeed, Stephanie Ashford, for joining us on this edition of the EMS Educator podcast. Don't forget, like, subscribe, follow us on wherever you get your podcasts. We're on all over social media. We're doing some amazing stuff. Don't forget to sign on and subscribe to the Prodigy catalog. We've got the education that you need right there at your fingertips in front of you on the screen. But for now, that's been another edition of the EMS Educator podcast. I've been Rob Lawrence. Thank you to the amazing guests and hosts today. Until next time, bye for now.